H.J. Smith, Reel 2.
And the people that took part in this were could come for a week, was a minimum. A fortnight was a maximum, in order to get as many in during the summer season of April to October as we possibly could. It was ram-jam full right from the opening, and it stayed ram-jam full until the closing. And it was such a success that the CNC decided that it would become a yearly feature. And in the last month of its operation, the staff that were going to run it the following year were sent there to pick up the threads in order that the following year, by which time we were moving out to Quetta and wouldn't be there available to do it, there would be a trained staff that knew what had happened the year before, and all the arrangements in connection with it were handed over en bloc for them.
What about drinking? Did you have a pub?
Yes. I'm glad you mentioned that. I'd forgotten it. In discussing it before we'd opened the holiday camp, I said to the officer that was commanding it, what about the canteen? What about hours of opening and closing? When will it? When would you like it to open? He said, in April. I said, yes, I know, we're all going to open in April, but I mean the time of day. When we open in April. So I said, well, we're going to open at Reveille on the morning of whatever date it was in April. And he said, well, that's when the canteen will open. And when will it close? He said, when we close. Do I understand you to say that the thing is going to operate the whole of the 24 hours? That's right, Sergeant Major, he said. It will open in April and it will close in October. So I said, is that going to be wise? All right. I ask about the canteen opening and closing times, and the officer commanding said that the canteen would open in April when we opened. So I said, well, we're going to open at, shall we say, at Reveille on whatever day it was in April, and well, that's when the canteen will open, said he. And what about closing hours? He said, we will close in October, and so will the canteen. Well, knowing the situation ordinarily in a wet canteen in a unit, I then asked him, would that be wise? And he said, Sergeant Major, this holiday camp is going to be so entirely different to barrack room life that that's what it will be. It will open in April, and it will close in October. When a man comes from the cinema or back from a walk at midnight, 10 o'clock at night, if he can't sleep, if he gets up at 3 o'clock in the morning and strolls down to the canteen, he knows very well he can get a light ale or a chota peg, whichever the mood takes him. And strangely enough, that's what happened. And at no time during the whole of the period of the summer did we have any cause to complain about these long opening hours. We arranged it so that we had a 24-hour shift system with staff and manned it accordingly. And there was no bother with it at all. Just recently, there's a scheme afoot in England to relax the licensing hours. And there's lots been said as to the unwise attitude of making it free for all. But there is a case where we had a canteen never closed, and there was not one case of abuse during the whole of the time. And I'm of the opinion that if the licensing laws in England were equally as free as that, in time, they would operate in a like fashion, without any bother at all.
Was your wife there with you?
Yes. Yes. She, well, the families were taken up each year, you see, from the plains to a hill station. And it happened, of course, that the hill station of Runny Ket was its name. was the hill station chosen for the first of the holiday camps that was run in India. And I believe it went on year after year after that.
What about the official brothel for the troops?
Well, this was before the brothel idea. There were very few women, Indian women, in the hills. They were all down on the plains. Very cold, you see. When the Indian settles somewhere, he's there forever. So they don't like up sticks in the hot weather and going up the hill. So there were very few women, Indian women, that is, in the hills at all.
Well, what did the troops do then?
Well, they just managed without, you see, until such time as they got down on the plains. There was the odd BB. I say there weren't any, but there would be the odd one, but there would be so few that they could be ignored.
What was the attitude of the wives in the married quarters towards the brothel in Kedah?
One of amusement, because the husband would say, well, now, oh, I know we had a story related in the mess. One chap asked his wife to lend him a rupee. So she said, I'm not going to lend you a rupee. You've got your own money. He said, no, I'm broke. Lend me a rupee. What do you want a rupee for? He said, I want to nip down to Flagstaff House, it was called, the brothel. And it was a matter of rivalry, of course, between the wife perhaps would say to the husband, hey, you get off down to Flagstaff House, I've had enough of you, or something like that, you see. Oh, it was a great talking point in the mess, and it caused endless fun amongst the families that way. But no married man, of course, ever got near the place.
Must have been hard work for the poor girls. Were they all Indian?
They were Indian girls, yes. No white-faced girls, you see. As I told you, they had to marry off the ship within 24 hours. So it's all Indian. And I think I can say this without fear of contradiction, second or third girl is a prostitute. And they start so young, you know, 16 years of age. There's a very wretched place. We're not on the air, are we?
Go on.
Oh, I mustn't. No, I mustn't.
You can always cut it out afterwards.
Well, there was a very wretched place in Bombay called Sakalaji Street. It was in the native quarter, right bang in the middle of the brothel area. And it consisted of what could only be described as cages. It was a long street about 50 yards long, with houses on either side. And if you started at number one, you got the best of the girls. And by the time you got along to number 25 or so, on the ground floor, that is, they were getting lower down the scale. They then moved upstairs to the far end, and the one at the far end was better than the one this end. By the time they got to that end, it really was dreadful. But they were a lot better than the ones this side, because from that end, they then moved down to that in rotation. It was a dreadful place. And it had, the girls used to sit in a room like this with bars down the windows, completely naked, inviting all and sundry, white, black, blue, yellow, grey, come on in. And they would expose themselves in most indecent ways in order to get somebody in. And when they did succeed, the charges were just pence. What they were making out of it was just coppers. It was a dreadful place, and it was known to all and sundry as the cages. A lot of people went there for the experience of seeing the dregs of degradation that humanity could sink to. It was the bottoms. I've never seen anything so degrading in any other part of the world that I've been.
Who organized that?
Nobody organized it, but it wasn't frowned upon by the civilian authorities. The civilian authorities in India regard prostitution in a different light to what we do at home. We don't allow it at home. And although they don't allow it in India, they don't stop it. They turn a blind eye to it. And that's how it goes on. Commanding officers of units were always very concerned of the high incidence of venereal disease in the battalions, and there was very little they could do about it. They had orders restricting troops' free entry into brothel areas, and regimental police used to patrol the areas to prevent it, but nevertheless there was always a high incidence of VD in battalions. And on one occasion when we were in Quetta, we had a very forthright officer as a commanding officer who, with the help of the Bishop of Lucknow, thought that one of the methods, the best methods to combat this, was to provide a regimental brothel. And after a while, this was finally agreed, and although it only ran for a very, very short time, it did succeed in what it set out to do. When one considers that to take a young man of 18 years of age, 19, 20, say from 18 to 26, away from female companionship in England, and put him into India where there's absolutely none at all, no provision of any kind. He doesn't see a white face apart from the married families. And to subject him to total abstinence for that large number of years in the prime of life is just, we're not on. It's beyond human tolerance. And therefore, the Bishop of Lucknow reluctantly agreed with the commanding officer to organize a regimental brothel. Flagstaff House was a large building nearby, about a mile from the barracks, which was unoccupied at the time. It was thought that this would be a suitable building in which to organize this. It was to be under strict medical supervision. The medical officer was to examine the girls each day. It started off with a team of six or seven girls, and they were subjected to medical supervision by the medical officer every day. They were thoroughly examined at the outset to make certain they were free and clear of any form of venereal disease. And the thing was publicized amongst the troops that the regimental brothel would begin to operate from the 1st of August in the year 1937. A medical orderly was detailed to live on the premises and to look after the girls, and it opened at about 7 o'clock in the evening of the 1st of August with a queue about a mile long. They didn't all get in, of course. It operated for about an hour and a half, 2 hours, and then closed down for the night. And after that, on the nightly openings, the queue eventually dwindled until eventually, after some several weeks, it became of manageable proportions. The orderly who was detailed to override all this, he would sit at the table at night, and the soldier would appear, pay his rupee, which was the fee charged, and choose a girl from small snapshot photographs on the wall, girls numbered from 1 to 7. He would say, number 3, perhaps, pay his rupee, he would be given a ticket bearing number 3, and then he would go and sit on a bench outside number 3 cubicle, where there may be 2, 3, or 4 people already waiting in front of him. And he would wait his turn, he would make his number with number three, and then, of course, disappear. That had the effect, of course, of curbing venereal disease. In fact, it almost ended, because one of the rules that the soldiers using the place had to be medically clear and free of all venereal disease. But after it operated for perhaps about 6 or 7 weeks, the church got hold of it. Adverse publicity began to seep. Questions, in fact, were asked at home here in England about it by none other, I believe, than Lady Astor herself. And pressure was brought to bear so much so on the project that eventually, after only a few weeks, they forced it to close.
We always hear so much about the sport among the regiments in India. Do you think that the men were supposed to play games to keep their minds off women?
And that was the intention. That was why all sorts of sports were promoted. That's why card games existed in messes and chess and tennis, and that was the outlet. The releasing of the safety valve.
Now, we've actually got ahead a bit. Why did you go to Quetta?
In normal events, you stay at a station for 3 years, you then move on. We were in Allahabad. The battalion was in Allahabad for its allotted span, and it was a routine move due anyhow. It could have been Quetta, it could have been anywhere else. It just happened to be Quetta, and it coincided with the clearing up after the earthquake. We weren't there at the time the earthquake happened. We got there afterwards and took part in helping to demolish damaged buildings, recovering their bodies and burials and that sort of thing, and in other words, helping to put the place to rights.
This must have been rather different from your normal routine work. Did you also carry out military maneuvers at this time?
No. There was a period of no training at all, whilst everything concentrated on the clearing up of Quetta and trying to get it back to normal. You see, things like water supplies, electricity and that sort of thing was just simply not on. The whole of it was completely wrecked. And parties of men would be called upon to help do this, that and the other, street clearing, demolition work, recovery of bodies, levelling areas, the recovery of property, segregation of the property so recovered, and that sort of business. During the earthquake and immediately afterwards, so much needed to be done with so few troops available to do it. And one of the main things was the adequate guarding of the area to prevent looting tribesmen coming in from the hills and looting the shops during the hours of darkness. And the staff college at Quetta, which fortunately escaped damage completely, took on the job of trying to help, as far as they were able, the civilian authorities to put matters to rights. And one of the things, of course, was the internal security. The commander of the staff college asked for volunteers to take on the job of the internal security arrangements. And to his delight, he got a volunteer from one of the Gurkha battalions, the commanding officer of whom said that he would take it on, provided he could do it in his own way without interference from outsiders. This was readily agreed to because it relieved the area commander of a great deal of responsibility, so that a battalion of Gurkhas were moved into the area to take on this task. The commander of the Gurkhas merely threw a single apron wire fence around the entire perimeter. I must add at this point that to people that don't know Quetta, that Quetta sits in the bottom of a basin, as it were, with hills surrounding all the way around. So that the stringing of a single apron barbed wire fence around the bottom didn't in effect keep people out, but the entire battalion was used at night as sentries at about 5 yards interval between each man, and by that means the entire perimeter was covered. Now the soldier's job wasn't to prevent the tribesmen coming in. They didn't stop him at all. He was allowed to come in without interference. But he met trouble when he tried to get out with his bag of swag over his back. Out popped a Gurkha, who immediately took the bag from him, and without more ado, with his cookery, sliced off the head of the hillman. The body was allowed to remain this side of the fence, but the head was thrown over to the other side. And I think the count of heads on the first night was no less than about 35. Night number two produced only about half that number. And by the time they got down to a week, the number of heads had dwindled down to only one or two. That had the effect of immediately putting a stop to the looting. But, unfortunately, the methods were so drastic that one couldn't allow people to go around carving off the heads of others willy-nilly like that. The battalion of Gurkhas had to be hurriedly withdrawn and other arrangements made in order to not to safeguard the life of the tribesman. His life was held very, very cheaply. But it was public opinion, I suppose, that put a stop to the Gurkha battalion on
did
duty.
Did people find out about this in England?
I think they did. Yes, I think they did. And it was as a result of pressure brought to bear from outside sources that the whole thing had to be scrapped.
How long did it take?
We were there for almost 3 years, and it was still going on when we left. Quetta was a very, very large city, and the whole of it was completely devastated. There was hardly a sound building left after the earthquake. Those that were left were in such a dangerous condition that they had to be demolished, so that the clearing up process was still going on when we in fact left the area for a new place. Had a dog, not because they were pet lovers, but merely because of the depredation of the Indian. They were expert burglars. They could be known, in fact, have done many times, go into your bedroom whilst you're fast asleep and even remove the sheet from under your body. They do it in such an expert way that you are aware of the loss of the sheet the following morning when you wake up. They cover themselves in grease. They're very, very slippery. They're completely naked, so that should they wake you during the night and you make a grab at them, they slither and slide and slip out of your reach and are away before you can do a great deal about it.
What would a dog be?
Well, when they knew you had a dog, of course, that did act as a deterrent. And anybody with a dog, of course, could be almost certain to be burglar-proof. But it wasn't always so, because there were things like poisoned meat. fed to the dog, and so it wasn't an absolute guarantee, but it did go a great deal part of the way. And on the subject of dishonesty, that also occurred in the domestic field. Wives had to keep a very, very close eye on the cook, so much so that you couldn't allow him to have, shall we say, a tea caddy in the cookhouse to make the tea. The tea caddy had to be kept in the house, and the empty teapot brought to the wife, who would spoon in the tea. The teapot be taken then back to the cookhouse by the bearer, and the tea made. But even then, one could tell by the strength of the tea that in between the journey of from house to cookhouse and water added, tea would be taken. Sugar was another thing. They've got a very, very sweet tooth, and unless you keep the sugar under strict supervision, you'd be surprised the number of pounds of sugar that a normal housewife with, say, two children and a husband can get through in the course of a week. At home, 2 or 3 pounds. But there, if not strictly supervised, anything up to 8 or 10 pounds. And the same thing went on for most of the other commodities, where they were able to steal it undetected. Believe you me, they would. They were absolute passmasters at the art of roguery.
Was there anything you could do about this? If you knew who'd been doing it, could you hand them over to civil authorities?
That was useless, because it was so general throughout the country that the prisons would be ram-jam full. The only way you could do it was no use sacking him, because the man you got afterwards would be equally as bad. And the only thing you could do about it, if you did discharge him, they always wanted a chit. They couldn't read English, of course, so you wrote out a chit and you faithfully said what you thought about him. If he was a rogue, you said so in no uncertain terms. And invariably one began one's chit by saying, "To whom it may concern." Please don't give away by facial expression anything that you are now about to read. The bearer of this chit, Mohammed Hussein, has been employed by me as a cook for 9 weeks. He's the biggest rogue unhung. He will steal your milk, take your sugar, take the tea out of the teapot without any shame whatever. He won't tell the truth. He's incapable of speaking the truth, so that if you approach him about filching the tea or sugar, he'll stare you in the face and say, "Not me, it's as you put it in." If you engage this boy after reading this, be it on your own head.